Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is lost when an ancient tongue fades into history, and what does it take to breathe new life into languages on the verge of extinction? Although more Native American languages are spoken in Oklahoma than any other U.S. state, many communities are concerned that their linguistic heritage will last only as long as the lives of its current speakers, depriving future generations of an important cultural and historical legacy. My guests today are working with Native populations committed to maintaining and increasing the numbers of people who speak the language of their tribes, and their recent efforts have been helped in part by a $48,000 research grant from the National Science Foundation. Mary Lynn is a linguist at the University of Oklahoma and curator of Native American language at the Sam Noble Oklahoma Museum of Natural History. Colleen Fitzgerald is associate professor and chair of UT Arlington's Department of Linguistics. Ladies, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for
asking us.
Thank
you for having us.
So how many Native American languages are actively spoken today in Oklahoma?
Actively spoken? Mm-hmm. Well, there's about 40 languages that historically have been spoken, and about 17 of those have no fluent first language speakers anymore. And about 5 to 7 of those have only one or two elderly speakers, 2, 3, or 4 elderly speakers. So you can kind of do the math. It's getting down there.
So that's a really scary place to be. Mm-hmm. What is lost? I mean, it's obvious that there's language traditions, but what do young people miss out on when they don't speak the language of their ancestors?
Well, they miss out on perhaps an opportunity to speak to their grandparents in their heritage language. They miss out on culture. They miss out on heritage that can't be expressed except through the language. There's a lot of loss.
So talk about how these started to be threatened. I know that when Native American kids were put into schools run by the government, that was a huge blow.
Yeah, the boarding schools really had policies of eliminating Native languages and having children assimilate to English and to American culture. And that has had a profound effect on people's desire, because of that painful experience, to transmit the language to their children.
Mm-hmm. It's rather... We're now very, very aware of things like PTSD. It's in the news a lot, and how that affects not just one generation but the next generation as well. And think of that: a community to a tribe to a nation fold of people that experience really traumatic events, from removal from the Southeast and from other places into Oklahoma. Children being torn from their families and sent to boarding schools for many years. After the boarding schools were abolished in the form that was sponsored by the United States government, there are still public schools which were very intolerant to any language other than English, and immigrant families experience this as well. So there's a big push for children to fit in. Young people are social creatures. They want to be liked by their peers, and so there's a big push to shift into English and leave their native languages behind. Statehood in Oklahoma, and before that allotment, was very devastating to the traditional economies, especially the agrarian economies. And so people were forced to either starve or find other kinds of jobs that pushed them into cities, these kinds of things that, again, disrupt the family life and the social fabric that were supportive of languages. World War II was, I think, one of the last blows for many of the smaller tribes in Oklahoma. Like all other wars, Native men, and in this case Native women as well, participated almost 100%. And this took the people out again of traditional economic, traditional home settings and into cities where they met other people from other tribes and other cultures. And the language of the home ceased to be a Native language because there were so many mixed marriages after that. And again, the economy was booming after World War II. And who doesn't want their children to be better off than themselves? So in order... they thought, and rightfully so at the time, that they had to make a choice. They had to either choose English or poverty. Hmm. And we know that that's not really the choice that's out there. You can be bilingual and do very well.
Well, you know, it's funny that we talk about the economic issues here because it does seem that in this country we've come around to the idea that it is useful to speak a language beyond English. But we often tend to couch that in terms of economic value. So people who do encourage their kids to speak another language, I have a neighbor who says, well, I don't want my son speaking my language. He can speak my husband's language, which is other than English, because there are a lot more speakers and he can make money using this language.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's been some psychological studies on the benefits, the cognitive benefits for children to be raised with two languages. So there definitely seem to be cognitive advantages to having a second language or a third language. There are, in many of these tribes, now economic opportunities for people who are involved in language revitalization work and language teaching. So those are some opportunities that are coming up. I think there's definitely a lot of advantages to this.
I'll jump in, Colleen. This, even if you can't get a job, let's say, speaking Sauk or Yuchi or one of these smaller languages, what we know from the Hawaiian native language programs, the Maori programs, Mohawk programs, is that the youth that go through immersion in their traditional, their heritage native language, do better in school overall. They enter college at a higher rate. They graduate at a higher rate. They get jobs and retain jobs at a higher rate, whether they're using that language or not. So in pure economic terms, it behooves everybody to support Indigenous language. It helps everybody out.
And Mary mentioned the Hawaiian example. Their immersion school has a 99% or 100% graduation rate from high school. And I think that's pretty impressive for a minority community in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
We would love to see all our citizens be well-educated and succeed in school and then go on to success in life. So,
well, Mary mentioned earlier, after World War II, a lot of Native Americans may have left their communities and married people from either another tribe or outside Native American culture entirely. Were there also times in history where smaller tribes were not subsumed as human beings, but their language, they sort of traded away what a small group of people spoke for what more of their neighbors spoke?
Definitely. There's many cases of assimilation like that. And as well, there were cases where new languages emerged with the contact of native languages and English and other languages. Mm-hmm. So like Mobilian trade jargon is one jargon.
It's part of the human condition, yeah. I think. Even before contact with Europeans, tribes assimilated to, you know, smaller tribes assimilated into larger tribes for a variety of reasons, protection, times of drought, these kinds of things. So we certainly know of cases, even pre-contact, immediately post-contact with the devastation of numbers in tribes because of disease and then immediate warfare. And we know that there was a lot of flux. That period was really pretty horrific. And we don't know a lot about the tribal history on the east of the Mississippi. There's big gaps because of everything that was in flux. And what emerged in our conscious, like the Muscogee Creek Nation, these are confederacies of smaller tribes of Muscogean-speaking people and non-Muscogean-speaking people that needed to work together in order to do things. And yes, there's a lot of language shift going on in that too, and a lot of stability. The Yuchi tribe has been associated with the Muscogee Creek Nation for hundreds of years, but they still speak their own language. And so sometimes we don't know why. Sometimes people shift and sometimes people don't.
I think we have a clip here of Muscogee. Mm-hmm. Let's listen to that.
Mojanetarat choga stijari bonaga isho chago hojari sibigorondomen istirat nak onagoji ohlin ohilin onayagiros mahogen istifolin. He jagemadat hayoat na jozi hagit aibat that nagi hiligodon huilaidondos isti abaldagio sabaklidondoesen istidat ajulagi hagibet aibat mad ponaka sages tago waget ohadalagen kilida istidat buidagioat manita gozigonoidostoesen kilagidayat Emahayal gerat pojolagosi hagiben idihijit for lead on those.
That was Muskogee, spoken by Margaret Maudlin. Do you know what she was talking about?
Maudlin is her last name.
Excuse me, Maudlin.
No, that's fine. She's just really beautiful, isn't she? she's reading from the Bible, one of the Gospels. I'm not sure which one there. She had a really wonderful project that she was very dedicated to in reading all of the books of the Bible that are in Muskogee Creek, and she recorded that at the museum, the Sam Noble Museum. And she didn't make it through the project. She's not feeling really well right now, but hopefully she'll feel good enough to get back to that project.
So talk about, I guess, recording is a big part of beginning to sort of get a handle on the loss of language. What sorts of things do you want to have on tape, and how do you use those things?
Well, I think you want everything you can get on recordings. There have been a lot of different ways people have approached this. Traditionally, linguists have done word lists and paradigms and grammatical elicitations and looking at how words are built in a particular language and what the unique sounds and how those sounds vary in different contexts and how sentences are constructed. But there's been a really, and then there's been a more anthropological approach for many years of trying to get different genres, different items of cultural relevance, songs, chants, rituals, healing information. What we're seeing in linguistics right now with a dramatic interest in language documentation because of the very intense consequences of language endangerment and globalization is a move towards trying to integrate linguistic approaches to recording with those anthropological approaches and trying to get as many genres and ways in which people actually use language, conversation, and things that are meaningful to communities. What I think Mary and I have both found in our work is that these historical archival materials that were collected years ago have so much value to communities, not just because they were related or knew the people in the recordings, but also because it conveys information that people might not have access to, or it might be conversational acts like telling legends that there's no one around who could maybe tell the whole cycle of legends. So trying to get as much information that's going to be valuable for that community in their projects.
So are you both fluent in all the languages that you work with?
No.
How does that work for you?
I can tell you about the grammar of a lot of languages. And I mean, speaking a language is very different in that you need to know the conversational norms and these kinds of things and have a wide vocabulary that sometimes as a linguist studying, you may not get that vocabulary richness as well. I would say I understand almost everything that I hear in Yuchi. A lot of it is practice, not getting enough time to practice. Mm-hmm. And that's the same problem that people in their own communities have. If you don't have very many elders or you don't have any at all anymore, where do you practice? How do you get the time to do this kind of thing? There's also some cultures are less accepting of outsiders coming in and immediately being able to speak better than people who have been trying to speak the language for many years. Mm-hmm. It's not a matter of, it's just a matter of how much time that person has had to spend. Oftentimes an academic, especially a graduate student, that's their job, is to learn about or learn this language. So they're very blessed in being able to do this. So sometimes there's some awkwardness that may keep linguists from becoming fully fluent.
Yeah. So. We have a project at UT Arlington working with the Chickasaw Language Revitalization Program in conjunction with their program director, Josh Hinson. And one of the things we're trying to do is balance what we're doing linguistically with trying to learn the language or some of the language to show as a courtesy, because people in that community, there's 80 speakers.
Let me jump right in. We need to take a quick break here. My guests this hour are linguist Colleen Fitzgerald, who is associate professor and chair of UT Arlington's Department of Linguistics, and Mary Lynn. She is at the University of Oklahoma and is curator of Native American language at the Sam Noble Oklahoma Museum of Natural History. We'll be back to our conversation in a moment. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed program that allows an unconventional approach to your graduate education. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
That is a little bit of Kiowa, as spoken by Parker McKenzie, my guest this hour, speaking about saving Native American languages, are Mary Lynn, she's a linguist at the University of Oklahoma, and Colleen Fitzgerald, associate professor and chair of UT Arlington's Department of Linguistics. They are sharing a National Science Foundation grant to fund research and workshops for preserving Native American languages. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. Obviously, we're talking about different languages, and there are many spoken across the United States. Just the cadence of that sounded so different from what we heard earlier with Muskoki. Is there much relationship between many of the languages that you work with?
Mary, you want to take this one?
Okay. In Oklahoma, there are 11 different language families. In Europe, there's three language families. Hmm. Okay, there's Indo-European, which is a huge family that spans Europe and India, parts of India, Pakistan, Afghanistan as well. And then there's Finno-Ugrican, which is Finnish, Hungarian, Sami. And then there's an isolate called Basque. 11 in Oklahoma alone.
Wow.
Yeah. There was 58 language families in North America north of Mexico at the time of contact. So the diversity is huge. So no, the Muskogee and the Kiowa that you heard, they are as wildly different as English and Chinese are. Muskogee does have some pitch accent. One of the things you were hearing in Kiowa was their tones. They mm-hmm. have three different tones. And then they have a very unique, probably the only language in the world that has a four-way distinction in the consonants. And so you were hearing some really beautiful articulation by Parker McKenzie there, getting to hear all those sounds. It's really nice. Yeah. Mm.
You were speaking, Colleen, before the break about the importance of showing respect for people who have spoken these languages for generations when you sort of come in as a new person.
Yeah, well, I was talking about the Chickasaw project we've been developing as a collaboration. So we've been going up weekly this summer and doing things with speakers. And yesterday, during our session, we were working with Joanne Ellis and Stan Smith and another speaker from the Language Committee, Geneva. And we basically ended up getting quizzed. And so, and I think it was a way of people wanting to see what we had been spending our time on and how we had done that. So Joanne was pretty amazing. There was an owl textbook, a kid's book without words, and we had to go around and describe the picture, mm-hmm. several pages of pictures, actually. The Chickasaw community is very vibrant and open, and they really want lots of visibility on their language. And so for them, that's their perspective, and that's how they would like things to be done. And they have so many things going on. They actually have an iPhone app that just came out yesterday. So, and it's free and available for anyone. So you could go to the iTunes store and download the app. Hmm. But as Mary said, you know, different communities have different perspectives on what they expect from you and whether they're going to have that perspective. And you have to be very respectful that different people will have different expectations.
So you mentioned this app and then the OWL textbook, which has no words in it. So my kids are of Mexican descent on their father's side. If I want them to study that, I can go to Half Price Books and find 50 different offerings. Are there textbooks available, particularly in these rarer languages?
Well, there are some cases. Actually, Chickasaw has a great textbook that Pam Monroe, who is a linguist at UCLA, and Catherine Willman, who is a Chickasaw speaker who lives in Los Angeles, part of the diaspora that Mary talked about earlier, that just came out a couple of years ago. Navajo has Rosetta Stone, and also there's a great new textbook that came out a few years ago in Navajo. So there's definitely some languages that have really good pedagogical materials. The language I've done a lot of work on, Dahana'atam, which is spoken in Arizona, has a pedagogical grammar that Ophelia Zepeda, who's a MacArthur Fellow, an Atam speaker and a linguist, published as decades ago. But nobody has the resources that languages like Spanish or English or French or Arabic have in their languages. So these communities are all at a big disadvantage in terms of having pedagogical materials, having speakers. Mm-hmm. So you can, finding speakers to practice with. So
it's one of the amazing things about Native language revitalization are the teachers that put so much of their time and effort. I mean, when you think they have to go from often having no pedagogical grammar to go back to for a resource, no curriculum, no materials, nothing, and they have to come up with it from scratch all the time, every day. Oklahoma allows Native languages to fulfill the foreign language requirement. Mm-hmm. So years ago, they changed the name to World Language Requirement. And people often ask me, well, why aren't more languages taught in the public schools then? Well, you know, it takes a really dedicated person to do this. And luckily, there are a lot of really dedicated people, but it is from scratch. And that's one way that linguists and graduate students can help. Is helping them create materials that they want in their classroom. The museum that I work in, we have a recording studio that we help teachers with if they want to record materials that they can use in the classroom, mm-hmm. or put online and these kinds of things as well. There's workshops around that help teachers to do this. There's no library of DVDs out there. You know, if you get tired of teaching that day, you can put on a Spanish DVD. It ain't out there.
Yeah, I think a lot of communities are also looking at ways that they can use technology to expand teaching. So there's online classes in Cherokee. There is the iPhone app that Chickasaw and Cherokee, and I think there's someone else who has an iPhone app, another Native American group. So people thinking about distance education.
Yeah.
There's also Hannah Corsello is a Chickasaw teacher and member of the language committee meeting, and she does a weekly Chickasaw word of the week. And so you get, if you're on her mailing list, you get a script that's typed up, but you also get an MP3, and you can listen to that. Mm-hmm. You can put that on your car, mm-hmm. Your iPhone track, and mm-hmm. listen to it in the car. And
Yeah. And there's a lot of sharing that goes on. Things from French or Spanish don't translate as easily, but picture books and DVDs that you can silence out, little things, and then you can put your own language over mm-hmm. it from different native languages work really well. So there's a lot of sharing going on. When I first started working with tribes in Oklahoma in the early 1990s, people were shy about doing that. They were worried about that cultural materials wouldn't be translatable very well, or they were shy about their own abilities, what they made. And so there wasn't as much sharing going on. And now there's a lot of it, which is really good. You don't have to reinvent the wheel. Mm-hmm. Phil Kashkash, who works mm-hmm. at the University of Arizona, comes up with these wonderful little, either old or ones that he's made, little video clips that you can easily put your own language under. And so, in sharing that, it just really goes a long way. So there's more and more out there, but definitely not like Spanish.
And one of the things I know that's going on in Oklahoma, Oklahoma Native Language Association does mm-hmm. Semesterly workshops. So something in October and something in April focused on language revitalization. And certainly the April workshop always has as a goal, having a takeaway, having mm-hmm. people learn linguistics in the morning on a particular topic, and then moving into how that topic is relevant in their language, how their language makes those distinctions. And then in the afternoon, putting together, say, a PowerPoint that could be done as a storybook, that could be a coloring book, or that could have an audio track. So something that you can take home and every year build on that curriculum. So
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Simi in Garland. Hi, Simi.
Hi. I'm so excited about this. I'm really interested in languages, and mainly because I grew up in an African country, and it seems like in those countries, everyone speaks three or four different languages, mm-hmm. and it was kind of a shock to come to the U.S. and everyone just speaks one language, or maybe two the most. But my main question was really about accents and how accents are transferred and learn from language to language, because it seems as though many people don't want to learn the language because they're afraid that it doesn't sound as right. And so that was just my main question, and wanted to hear the opinion from linguists.
Well, definitely, there's a lot of research on second language acquisition about accents and accent acquisition. And certainly one of the factors that plays a role is what age you are when you acquire that second or third language. And many times, if you're past puberty, that it's harder for you to end up with an accent that's going to have you sounding like a native speaker of that language. Another factor is what you mentioned, people feeling inhibited, having that affect inhibit them in terms of their learning. So we know that this is something we see in adults, mm-hmm. especially. So the lesson we can take away from this is, if you want to learn a language, or you want your children to learn a language, or grow up being bilingual or trilingual or quadrilingual, have them have access as early as possible, as young mm-hmm. as possible. Speak the language often. Speak it in the home.
I think, unfortunately, this is something that holds back a lot of adult Native people from learning their languages. Traditionally, in many of the Native cultures, but not in all, teasing is used as an educationally. Mm-hmm. And it can be very intense. And in some cases, to outsiders, it seems very mean, the level of teasing that can go on. And when you tease somebody about accent, about their ability to use their first couple words in a language that they're trying out, often that can inhibit them forever. And they quit speaking and they quit trying to learn the language. And then there's many, many cases of adults who have said, well, I started to learn and I got laughed at, so I quit. So there is a push in many of these communities to drop teasing at the door mm-hmm. and basically say teasing is a valued part of our culture. We do it in other places, but we won't do it in our language classes. And really being conscious that this is really detrimental, especially to the adults. It's just a cultural thing. And they're aware of it now, and many of them, and are really working against that. So, but it comes out in accent. It doesn't come out in other things, you know. But it is there when people have an accent. So, yeah.
Do all these languages? Did they have any kind of written tradition before European Americans came in and sort of shared Western characters and things like that?
Before Europe, no, except in Central America. Uh-huh. The Olmec tradition, it became Mayan and these kinds of things. Yes, there is there. And that was a separate innovation from Europe or Middle East. But most of the modern writing systems are just that. They are either inspired from Native people who saw the language being written by other people, such as Sequoia with the Cherokee syllabary, or from missionaries. Some tribes have rejected missionary writing systems. Others have fully embraced them. The Muscogee Creek is a missionary based. The Cree writing system, syllabary, is missionary based. More recently, there's been a working with often linguists or educators to help the tribe decide on symbols and go from there. So they're more tribally inspired.
So, of course, a great motivation for learning to read a language is write a language rather and read it is having a lot of material to read. What's the situation in terms of literature written in Native languages?
Well, one way to think about this is that these communities have tremendous oral traditions. So you have a large oral literature that's out there, and in a number of communities, some of those materials have been recorded or have been already written down in the language or in some cases in translation only. So there is actually quite a literature tradition. It's just a tradition that we're maybe not always thinking about in the Western tradition. If we think about something like Beowulf, that's oral literature as well. That's mm-hmm. the oral tradition. So there is actually a tremendous literature. And then there's people who are taking and making modern takes on things as well. So I mentioned Ophelia Zepeda earlier, and she's a poet who writes in English and in Otham. So there are people who are taking and creating a new literature in a modern way.
Are these languages still evolving and adding new words and new expressions?
Oh, yes.
Every language changes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the Chickasaw Nation and the Sauk language program that are actively modernizing their vocabulary because youth weren't speaking or being raised in the language, youth are the great changers for everything, mm-hmm. honestly. You know, they weren't incorporating new things that were coming in as fast as languages where youth are actively speaking the language. So there's a big gap where new technology especially was not getting named. And so to modernize, you feel, these tribes really feel this big lurch, you know, oh, our language is really changing because all of a sudden they're having to and coming up with new words for a lot of things. Cherokee, some languages that have had more speakers of different ages for longer periods, it's not as abrupt a change that they're seeing. But yeah, they're definitely incorporating new words. And what's exciting is when the younger kids start really making words up on their own, because that's mm-hmm. natural. That's actually how language works. So.
Last night I was at the Chickasaw Language Committee meeting, which is Chickasaw elders, and they're coming up with new words every meeting. It's once a month. So last night on the agenda was nerd. So they actually tabled it for the discussion at the next meeting. But
there was that they did that while the linguists were there.
Yeah, there was some pointing our direction, trying to explain what a nerd was. And
own it proudly.
We tried to. It's pretty exciting. I've been going to those meetings, I don't know, I think the last four or five of them. And what I love about it isn't, in this case, it's typically the elders who are doing this. But what's amazing is to be there in the presence of people who are debating in their language, mm-hmm. what's the authentically Chickasaw way to express something. Mm-hmm. So even if the concept isn't something that's traditional, what they're doing is they're really having this meta discussion in their language. And it's great. The people are making jokes, making wordplay in mm-hmm. Chickasaw. And so having that aspect of things, you know, what we hope is what Mary said, is that there will be something that catches on with the young people, that they will use things. And certainly, you know, there are people like Josh Hinson from Chickasaw who's tweeting Chickasaw word a day and Facebooking it, and OLL for LOL.
Which actually works out with the Chickasaw. Yeah.
Let's very quickly here. We have to go to a break in a moment, but let's speak with Jeremy in Dallas. Hi, Jeremy.
Oh, hello. Chukma.
Yeah. Chukma. Ching Chukma.
I just wanted to call and thank these two ladies for what they're doing. I'm Chickasaw. And my dad asked me to try to learn the language with them for Father's Day. So and we got the information from the Nation. And I just want to say thank you very much for what you're doing.
Jeremy, thank you so much for your call. We are speaking about saving Native American languages with two linguists. My guests this hour are Mary Lynn from the University of Oklahoma and Colleen Fitzgerald from UT Arlington. We'll resume our conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join us online by sending email to think@kera.org, or you can call in to 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed graduate program that allows you the chance to meet the challenges of society. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
Ehiaha. Sio meil. Sio an avokaskila. Katasta ihanska. Ostin eilen lyhtsiitin aukon sy lahustaan eili tolle. Harrytu lahustaan ehostin eil. Sinne tehdä kuastit ja taa teihin musko. Ja laa juuleen ja taa teihin musko. Ja kun tuu yli kohdisti tuleen ahun. Ylaktis ju teihin johti. Ylaktitaan atisko.
That was Cherokee there. The speaker is unknown. My guests this hour are linguists Mary Lynn from the University of Oklahoma, who's also curator of Native American language at the Sam Noble Oklahoma Museum of Natural History, and Colleen Fitzgerald, associate professor and chair of UT Arlington's Department of Linguistics. They are sharing a National Science Foundation grant to fund research for preserving Native American languages. If you'd like to join us, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. We have an email here from Hank in Dallas who asks, did the forced migration of Eastern tribes to Oklahoma in the 1830s create any significant differences between the language spoken in the Eastern and Western groups?
Yes.
Yeah, definitely.
One of the main things is that you pull people from their native land. And they, you take them to a land that is significantly different, to even moderately different, and you lose place names for one thing, but you lose all the words for the flora and fauna. Mm. Some of them will shift. You use a term for a species that looks similar, but a lot of things you don't know. You don't have names for a lot of tribes. If you ask them, you know, a list of words for fish or bird that had been recorded pre-removal, they have no idea what these are anymore. And they may have more generic words for fish and birds and things. So a lot of that language just simply gets lost. So that was a major change.
And the vocabulary that Mary's talking about, the flora and the fauna, that's vocabulary that's vulnerable in endangered languages anyways. Mm-hmm. Often that might reflect knowledge that the most specialized speakers have. In terms of the gathering of plants or cultural traditions that are involved with working with the land. So you add in removal, mm-hmm. and it's right. Lost knowledge.
The Cherokee clip is actually a good example, is that the Cherokee that remained in North Carolina didn't do something that the Cherokee that were removed to Oklahoma did, and that was acquire tone. So the Cherokee in Oklahoma have a tonal system to the language now. There is some tone in North Carolina Cherokee, but it's just not the same. And this is a very recent, very major change between the two languages that are otherwise mutually intelligible.
And so, did we hear a clip from Oklahoma or from
Oklahoma Cherokee? Okay. Right. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And in fact, the writing system Cherokee with the syllabary doesn't indicate tone. So the NSF and the round of funding that we got also mm-hmm. funded a collaborative project with the Cherokee Nation and several universities that will document tone and document tone in various speakers, because it's not in the writing system. So there's an mm-hmm. element that you can't get out of their writing system.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the phones now at 800-933-5372. We have Bert on the line in Dallas. Hi, Bert.
Hi. You know, as a reader of Lewis and Clark, I was struck by the convoluted communication between English and French, and then Sacagawea played a key role in bridging two different tribes, you know, to help them, get across the country. But I think even in those journals, there was some talk about sign language. I understand that there was a real comprehensive sign language that existed across much of the continental United States. And I was wondering if you couldn't talk about that some, and you know, how well these tribes could really communicate with each other and for how long they had been developing.
Thanks for your call.
Yes, this is Mary. I'll answer this as best as I can. Yes, there is what's called plain sign language or plain sign talk, and it was a trade jargon, actually. To back up a little bit, there was multilingualism across what is now the United States. Mm-hmm. So Colleen was talking about the Mobilian jargon in the Southeast and the Northwest Coast. There was a trade jargon as well, because people traded. They were in communication with each other. There was intermarriages, so people knew a lot of languages. So you could go from one point to another with the languages you knew, pick up people that spoke the next couple of languages. So you could go pretty far. But the Plains is a really massive, large area. And again, lots of different language families that had or recently moved out into the plains with the reintroduction of the horse. So plain sign talk really started with more of this reintroduction. And it was a way to communicate with each other when you did not have a common language. It was still spoken for many, many years and is on the decline like other languages as well. The languages, the southern plains tribes like Kiowa, Cheyenne, and Arapaho, they began using it more as an enhancement for storytelling. So the clip on I'm not sure if we're going to play, of Cheyenne, he's actually in that clip using plain sign talk, which you can't hear, along with what he was talking about. Mm-hmm. So it became an enhancement. It also took hold in deaf communities. And so there is, again, a DEL, a Documented Endangered Languages grant from the NSF that is looking, going through places that most researchers don't have access to, and that's the deaf communities, to see who is still using it and how it's changed over the years as well.
Yeah, I think there was mm-hmm. a big gathering last summer mm-hmm. among plain signers to document what's going on. And, you know, I think it's really, we keep mentioning the NSF funding for documenting endangered languages, but I think it is important in our current budget climate, because that is a program that's under siege and may end up being cut, and as well as the Social and Behavioral Directorate for NSF.
So, for all of linguistics and anthropology.
We're very fortunate to be able to do this work that we're doing, as well as these other projects we've mentioned, because they are really representing a unique part of American heritage in terms of our language. This is something that's a shared history for our country.
Well, how far does $48,000 go? It doesn't seem like a lot of money.
That's actually half.
That's my the UT Arlington part.
So you
part.
Each have
about
the, it's about a $90,000 grant.
That grant is specifically for a workshop entitled Breath of Life, Silent No More. These type of workshops were developed in California, which is very similar to Oklahoma in that there's a lot of smaller tribes that have very few or no speakers of the languages left. The term was developed by a wonderful language worker, Elle Frank, and she came up with the name. And we're very thankful because it really says everything. These are workshops that target people who have no first language fluent speakers left. They may have good second language speakers that are really working to learn the language, but they don't have any elder, anybody they can fall back on and say, how is this said? Or have a conversation so we can see what a conversation was even like. Nothing like that. And so the idea is that the languages aren't dead. There's documentation. There's the will out there to revive the languages. And there's the know-how really now to how to do it. And so they're silent for a while, but we want them spoken again. And in Oklahoma, because of the number of tribes that don't have 17, at least that do not have active first language speakers, we are wanting to target those groups that really fall through the hole. These workshops, the Oklahoma Native Language workshops, I taught those for years, but they really do target people who have access, either speak their own language or working with their grandmother right there beside them. So we're really trying to target people that all they have really to understand and learn the language are things that were put into archives, that are sitting in their houses at their own homes in recordings that are out there that are underused, and get those out there, get those used, see what's in there, and learn, teach people how to use those so that they can understand their language and learn their language.
And part of the project is, as Mary mentioned, using these legacy materials and archival materials and trying to increase access from the community members. And one of the things we talked about in our grant proposal was pulling a databasing element in there and really seeing how these revitalization projects create new documentation, even in a case where there aren't speakers, first language speakers. But, you know, if we think about the long linguistic tradition of Latin and Greek, you know, there's a lot we can learn from the materials that were documented. So
let's go back to the phones now. This time our caller is Carl in Fort Worth. Hi, Carl.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks.
I just wanted to say that maybe one reason that Native Americans have lost their ability to speak the language is because at one time there was a government policy to remove Native American kids from their homes and families and from the reservation and send them to Indian schools such as Carlisle in Pennsylvania and Hampton Institute. Now, one of the reasons was to strip them of their cultural belief, their religious belief, their language, cut their hair, and basically to make them white Indians.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. It's a very tragic part of our history
after the Civil War.
Yeah.
It was the actual stated policy of the United States to remove children from the home and to take English away in order to civilize them.
A lot of these schools weren't actually, I think, really trying to do education in the sense that what they were really doing was more, in some cases, like in some of the schools in Arizona, transferring kids into lives of menial work, so creating servants. So this isn't really what we might think of as education. And the schools, I think, just had a very devastating effect on a particular generation it's just hard to.
As I said earlier, we're still feeling the consequences today. I had a class last semester where we were working developing a Kiowa dictionary for the Kiowa classes at OU. And we had an elder who came up to visit us one night and share her knowledge with us. And she couldn't get into the elevator. It was so hard for her because, again, this is post-boarding school policy, but still the boarding school attitudes were corporal punishment. And she was disciplined by being put in very small closets. And so to get into a small space was still very difficult for her. And part of that was, again, taking the language away. So it's still with every Native family.
I mean, and even in the schools that weren't residential, a few years ago, I gave a guest lecture at Dohnanyi Community College in Sells, Arizona, and I was talking about language endangerment, and we were talking also about the Otham language and its status, and one of the gentlemen in the class, who was probably in his late 40s, shared his experience in one of the BIA, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, local schools, where he had said something in Otham when he was a five-year-old, and the teacher got very upset, took him into the bathroom, and washed his mouth out with soap for using his language. So it wasn't just the boarding schools. There were sort of several generations and iterations of these policies.
And honestly, I mean, the public schools still have this kind of attitude to some degree, whether there is corporal punishment involved or not. And part of it is that teachers are overworked. In that they don't have time to deal with differences. But there is the attitude is that you're here in America, you need to speak English. Well, I'm sorry, but these languages were here first. And, you know, people are still scared. It goes from embarrassed to scared about speaking their own language in Walmart. I have people who say, you know, we were trying to speak Creek in the grocery store or Miamia or Cherokee, and people came up to us and told us that we needed to speak English. You know, there's just an intolerance to different languages. And if we were kind of talking about this before you turned on the recordings is that, you know, it's language is tied up with identity, and it's a very personal thing what we speak with our children and what we speak with our grandparents. And we all have the right. It is a fundamental right.
Well, it's a
human right. Yeah. It's now
in UNESCO's human Declaration of Human Rights.
That you have the right to speak whatever language you want. And we should be embracing this and enjoying this, that this is really part of the fabric of America, all the languages that come here or have been here. So.
Yeah, and I guess I would say, too, I heard someone make this comment. In other parts of the world, often, being able to speak more than one language is viewed as a high social status. Mm-hmm. But in the U.S., it's really frowned upon. And I think that has a whole lot of consequences in general, that attitude for our economic survival as a country, as our political survival. We really do benefit when we have multilingual citizens. And when whether people are speakers of indigenous languages or immigrant languages to the U.S., that's really a tremendous cultural and intellectual resource, and it should be really cherished.
Mm-hmm. We just have a few seconds left, but are children really as interested in this as anybody else within these communities?
In many cases, yes.
Mm-hmm. In the early 1990s, when I worked with language teachers in Oklahoma, that was their biggest hurdle and frustration was they couldn't get younger people interested. And now the major problem is that there's not enough teachers to keep up with the student interest. So it is going to change. That's the beginning of everything changing.
Definitely.
Mary Lynn is a linguist at the University of Oklahoma, Colleen Fitzgerald at UT Arlington. They are recipients of a National Science Foundation grant to fund research dedicated to documenting and preserving Native American languages. It's been wonderful to have both of you here. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having us.
Thank you, yes. Great.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.